Here in Pennsylvania, there's a rush to drill for natural gas in the rock formation called the Marcellus Shale. This drilling is associated with several environmental concerns, but most notably, water quality. Hydrofracking, the kind of drilling that's done in the Marcellus, is currently exempted from the Safe Water Drinking Act. I'm here in the WPSU studio with three experts from Penn State. Tom Murphy is an educator with Penn State Cooperative Extension and co-director of the university's Marcellus Initiative for Outreach and Research. Hi, Tom.
Good evening.
Brian Swistock is Penn State Extension Associate who specializes in water resources issues. Hi, Brian.
Hello.
And Dave Yoxheimer is a hydrogeologist with ARM Group Incorporated, a State College environmental consulting firm. He's also a grad student in Penn State's College of Earth and Mineral Sciences. Great to have you with us, Dave.
Thank you.
All of our guests have spent significant time working both with the State Department of Environmental Protection and with representatives from drilling companies. They're here tonight to answer your questions. You have a couple of ways to join our conversation. You can call us toll-free, 1-800-543-8242. That's 1-800-543-8242. You can also send us a question by email to radiolive@psu.edu. That's radiolive@psu.edu. And you can also join our live chat online at wpsu.org/gasrush. There's just one ground rule tonight. We're going to focus on water-related issues exclusively. If you have other questions related to drilling in the Marcellus Shale, please hold them for a future forum. Let's start by reviewing the ways that water can be a concern when drilling for natural gas. At the most basic level, you simply need a lot of water to drill a well, and it has to come from somewhere. So, Brian, how much water and where do drillers get it?
Well, it's usually around 1 to 5 million gallons of water for each well. They can get it from a variety of sources, and the concern is, will that water come from small trout streams up in the headwater areas where it might have a pretty detrimental impact, or will it be purchased water, or will it come from large rivers? So really where that water comes from and when they take it is one of the big concerns.
And there is a permitting process and regulations in place, and we'll talk more about that in just a little bit. Another point of concern is when the well itself is being drilled, and these are very, very deep wells, and if the well isn't installed properly, there's a potential for contamination of drinking water that's groundwater. Tom, tell us a little bit more about that, how that works.
When energy companies are doing the work, actually the drilling subcontractor that's doing the work, and they drill through the groundwater, they have to protect that groundwater. Typically, they drill on air to protect it, and then once they go down through that, then they have to put in metal casing. That metal casing that is surrounded with the cement, and that's what protects the groundwater zones.
Right. Okay. And then we talked about needing a large volume of water. That's for this process called hydrofracking, where the water is injected underground at very high pressure to split the rock apart and release the gas. And it's not just plain water. There's some chemicals that are added to it, and then that water comes back up. So, Dave, tell us a little bit about fracking fluids.
Yeah. Well, when they're hydrofracturing the formation, which is really necessary to make the Marcellus Shale economically viable, they're using a mixture of about 99% sand and water. And the sand acts as a proppant to actually hold those fractures open. And then on the order of 1% are various additives to basically help the water penetrate deeper into the formation and prevent any plugging and corrosion in the well.
And then finally, one other point of concern comes from the building process, from making the well pads and from putting roads into forests. And that can affect trout streams in a different way, right, Brian?
Yeah, these Marcellus sites are quite a bit bigger than our traditional gas drilling sites. These are typically maybe a 5-acre clearing with roads and pipelines also added into that. So when you have a disturbance that size, especially if it's located near a stream, you have to be very careful with erosion and sediment control to make sure that you don't have a lot of runoff getting into streams.
Right. That can really muck things up for the trout.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. I have an email question here. This is from Catherine. And she notes that she pays each month for water, as do other individuals and businesses. And she would like to know, how much are gas companies paying for the water that they use? And who gets the money, and where are they getting the water? So let's start with the first part. How much do gas companies pay for water, Tom?
Would depend on which company it is and what the actual water company is selling their water for, but they would be selling it to the energy companies just like they would be selling it to a private resident.
So, for instance, drilling is starting to heat up a little here in Center County. Where would those companies look for water?
Companies would go to a water company that actually has excess capacity that they can sell by permit from the, in this case, the Susquehanna River Basin. And they would be purchasing it from that water company.
So the question of who would get the money, so that would go to the water company.
Go to the water company, and they would be selling that water by permit, just like they would do to any other consumer of that same water.
And then this question, where are they getting the water? So in part it could be from a company, but in some cases water is withdrawn from surface water sources.
That would be the most common because of the volumes of water that we're talking about here, in most cases.
And that in some cases that could be surface water that's not controlled by a water company?
It could be surface water that could be a stream, typically a large stream or a river that where there's a lot of capacity there.
And in that case, would there be any monetary transaction, or how would that work? Yes, go ahead, Dave.
Basically, if you want to have a surface water intake permitted on a creek, stream, river, you do have to pay fees to the Susquehanna River Basin Commission. And once you pay all your permit fees, basically it's at the company's expense, whatever it costs them to actually pump the water, you know, design an actual intake, pump that water, and transfer it to their well site via trucks or direct piping.
And let's talk a little bit more about the permitting process. This is something that has developed rapidly in Pennsylvania in response to the interest in drilling. Talk about the permitting process and the role of the Susquehanna River Basin Commission. Brian, is that a question mostly for you?
The permits have gone through some changes over time. They had to adapt pretty quickly to this industry, update their permits, change the processes, streamline some things where they could. Add new people in as well, but they have to review each of those permits and make sure that the impact on the stream is not going to be detrimental to downstream users. So there's a whole analysis, a whole model that goes into effect to determine what impact there will be, and if it's not an important impact, then they'll go ahead and issue the permit.
And Dave, that's something that you work with drilling companies on to sort of guide them through that process?
Right. Yeah, we've helped permit various intakes across the state. And again, it's pretty different ballgame if you're in the Susquehanna River Basin, because you have the Susquehanna River Basin Commission and they have their own set of rules. And then if you're outside in basically Western Pennsylvania in the Allegheny River or Ohio River Basin, you're working with the DEP and they've adopted a similar set of regulations. So it's pretty similar across the state nowadays.
We have a question here from Rick in Stormstown. He would like to know how much monitoring are state regulators doing to ensure that the disposal of excess fracking fluid is not polluting our water supply? So fracking fluid comes back up out of the ground. Something has to be done with it. How is it monitored? How is it regulated? Brian?
Well, there's a lot of different regulations. They do have to track that return water, which is typically in the order of 15% to 25% of what is put down in the ground comes back as a return or a wastewater. And that does have to be tracked to determine where it's going to go, whether it's going to be reused or whether it's going to go to a treatment facility or an injection well in another state. And there's a variety of regulations that control all aspects of that.
We have a question from Greg in our live chat, and he says, fracking is affecting water table levels. How can measurements be taken to change this, or how will measurements be taken to change this? So is that correct? Fracking is affecting water table levels. Dave, you're shaking your head.
Well, no, it's not affecting the actual water table level. When you're considering that the near surface aquifers are, you know, basically in the upper, let's say 1,000 feet, and then there's 4,000 feet or more of relatively impermeable bedrock between the bottom of the aquifer and the Marcellus Shale, the downhole operations in the Marcellus Shale are going to have, in essence, zero impact on water table levels in the near surface aquifer.
So just to clarify, if you think of a slice through the ground, these gas wells are very, very deep, and the level of the water table is up above the level where they're actually drilling out horizontally.
Correct.
So the fracking fluid wouldn't be expected to mix with the water in the water table.
Correct. When you're looking at how far outward the hydrofracturing effect has on the Marcellus wellbore, you're looking at on the order of maybe, 500 feet. So it only extends outward that far. So it doesn't extend up thousands of feet to the water table.
Tom, you'd like to add something?
Yeah, the other thing to keep in mind is the initial comment we made about the well casing that's there in the cementing process. And that's what would seal off any type of interaction or communication between that hydrofracking process and the water table above it. So with that in place and the integrity of that process in place, then you would not have any exchange here. And with no exchange, then you would not have any effect on the groundwater zone.
So, I guess the Gulf spill demonstrates that that's assuming the integrity and that it's possible in some cases that that could fail. It's not fail safe.
Well, and that would be some of the examples that we've seen in a handful of cases where we've seen methane gas migration, which has been dealing with that the integrity issue, thinking about that cementing process in three different places that we're aware of in Pennsylvania, most of them being in Susquehanna County.
We have a question here about how fracking water is handled. This is from Jeff on our live chat. He'd like to know, can frack water be purified and then used for things like irrigation in an area that doesn't have enough clean water? Brian, you're sort of nodding your head a little bit.
Well, you can take anything out of water, pretty much. It's all a matter of how much you're going to spend to do it. And you can. You can certainly treat frack water and get it to a very pure level, even to drinking water standards. Is that going to be done on a large scale? Probably not. They're going to reuse a lot of the water, and probably ultimately some of it will be treated to a very high level. In those cases, it'll probably be reused for fracturing. It might be the simplest thing to do.
Now, in states like West Virginia, a lot of the fracking water goes to treatment plants that are equipped to handle the chemicals, but recycling is becoming more and more common in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, it's increasing rapidly in response to the economics of all of this, the realization that we're not going to be able to dispose of the water in streams like we have in the past, going to have to treat it to a higher level. That's going to cost more money. When things cost more money, people come up with new ideas, and that's where reuse and recycling has really taken off.
Tom, did you want to add something to that?
Just maybe another comment there about in Pennsylvania, we also have commercial facilities that are set up to actually go through the processes that Brian is talking about, where they actually treat the water. Typically, they treat and take out a lot of the constituents, the heavy metals, the chemicals, those portions, but not typically the salt. So those are the issues then that really become expensive.
And does Pennsylvania have sufficient treatment plants that can do that to handle all the fracking water that's created?
Right now, there's capacity to deal with all the water that's being created, but that's making the assumption that some of that water is going back into the reuse, recycle scenario, and also some of that's being shipped to some of the neighboring states and being injected in underground wells, disposal wells.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to WPSU-FM. We're talking about Marcellus Shale drilling and its impact on water quality. Give us a call with your question at 1-800-543-8242. That's 1-800-543-8242. You can also send us a question by email to radiolive@psu.edu. That's radiolive@psu.edu. And you can also join our live online chat at wpsu.org/gasrush. Well, we've been talking about how you handle fracking fluid, and here's a follow-up question from Rick in Stormstown. He notes that sometimes there can be illegal dumping of fracking water, and he'd like to know what penalties are in place or what systems are in place for dealing with a situation like that. Dave?
Well, I think with any illegal dumping, there's a pretty severe penalty involved with that. I don't know of any specific cases where if any fines have been levied, it's against people storing the water illegally because there are residual waste regulations in the state that, govern how you can handle that water.
So, and DEP is responsible for enforcement.
Correct.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All right. We have a question here from Carol in our online chat, and this relates to the issue of water volume needed for drilling. She says, where do drillers plan to get the water that's needed to drill? She notes that within the past 5 years, we've had drought warnings in this area. So does Pennsylvania have enough water to support the amount of drilling that's projected to be happening soon?
If we go back to that permitting idea of determining how much water can be withdrawn, they basically look at the flows during droughts, and that's what they base their decisions on. So they don't look at normal water flows. They look at how much water is in a stream when there's a drought, and that's how they determine if they're going to allow that water withdrawal. So it's assuming a drought is occurring, really.
So gas drilling simply could not expand if it was a year where there wasn't enough water.
Yeah, there would be stipulations even that when a stream drops to a certain level, they couldn't withdraw any more water from it.
Dave, you're nodding your head. You wanted to add something.
Well, I was just going to say many streams have pass-by flow requirements. So if the stream does get below a certain flow level, even if there are permitted withdrawals on that stream, they have to cease until the stream levels get up to a higher level.
Tom?
We're also seeing companies that are starting to strategically locate storage ponds so they can store water for those type of situations. So if there's a low flow period, they would have water in reserve for mm-hmm. that moment in time.
And I assume the permitting process addresses that sort of advanced withdrawal of water.
There would be, and there's also DEP permitting to deal with the dam that would be involved, the structure that would be involved to actually hold them, including the liner.
I have a multi-part question here from Catherine by email. And Dave, you started to talk a little bit earlier in the show about the components that are added to fracking water. Catherine says, I understand that companies are allowed to keep these materials a secret. Is this true? That's the first part of the question.
Yes, they do not have to disclose their secret recipe.
But some companies voluntarily disclose, though not all.
I think most of them have, and it's really not a big secret what they're using nowadays. If you go online on the PAMarcellus.com website, you can see a listing of the chemicals that are typically used in a frack.
Now, is it the case that although the components might be listed, the concentrations of each are proprietary?
No, actually, there is a list of the approximate or the range of concentrations, and they are small fractions. As I said, 99% approximately of a frack fluid is sand and water. The other 1% are these chemical additives that are, you know, a little more secretive.
And Catherine notes that it is allowed that this composition be secret, and she asks, how could we get that changed? What assurance do we have that the materials are not a danger to health? Do companies report what they're using to an agency?
Well, they're required to test their flowback water quality and test for key parameters that would have, you know, toxic characteristics, if you will. So there is testing of that flowback water prior to disposal to make sure it's not of a, you know, extremely harmful composition.
Mm-hmm. We have a call. We have Rick from State College on the line. Hi, Rick. What's your question?
Hi. I have two, if I can, and I'll admit in the beginning I'm a skeptic.
Can we take them one at a time?
Okay. The wells, say, by the State College Water Authority go very, very deep. But all over Pennsylvania are wells drilled at the beginning of this last century used by individuals for homes and farms. And the shale is below it. As the shale is fractured, a certain percentage of the gas will percolate up and into the water table. When these people's wells start showing up with the gas in it, what are they supposed to do in terms of a water supply?
Dave, I think you can answer that one.
Yeah, well, Rick, I would say that when a well is fracked, you don't have methane migrating up from the Marcellus Formation to the near-surface aquifer. There are actually naturally occurring levels of methane that pre-exist in areas where there's been no drilling. And to protect well owners, basically the companies are required to notify any well owner within 1,000 feet. And that's actually going to increase to probably 2,500 feet in the near future, and have their wells tested both before and after the well is drilled and fractured to make sure that there are no effects.
Well, that sort of reminds me what the president of BP said about water getting in or oil getting into the Gulf. And I grew up in the Lackawanna Valley, where the mines of a century ago just sucked all the water they needed to mine out of the Lackawanna River and then discharged it downstream. And I saw miles of river with no vegetation on 40 feet in either direction because the waste just killed it. So companies that do mining and gas exploration, don't have a very good track record in this state of cleaning the water after they use it.
Well, coal mining and natural gas drilling are really two pretty different operations. So, yeah, I can understand where you're coming from, and we do have legacy issues with coal mining. But I think we're seeing a very highly technical level of science being applied to the natural gas industry to prevent any issues.
And Brian would like to add something here.
Yeah, I think it's just important to note that if everything is done correctly and the integrity of the well is constructed properly, that these problems shouldn't occur. That doesn't mean they won't ever occur in any case. Things do happen, and we've all seen that. And that's where the pre-drilling water testing is very important, to document the conditions of your water so that you can prove if those things happen. And with something like methane, you would see that. You would notice the water bubbling or effervescing. You wouldn't have any odor to it, but you would see a pretty apparent change to the water, and that would be a time when you would call the DEP to have them investigate it if there's nearby gas drilling.
Rick, thanks for your call. We have a call from Michael in State College. Michael, you're on the air. What's your question?
Okay. The question is that he just answered part of the question, actually. Brian did. To be concerned, how far the drilling activity has to be away from my well? I mean, like maybe 1,000 feet, mile, half a mile, to be concerned about my water to be contaminated?
No simple answer to that. There is no magic number. The current regulation provides a maximum protection for people that are within 1,000 feet, and the majority of the problems in the past have been experienced within that distance. But there have been some that have gone out several thousand feet where there have been problems. So there's no magic cutoff number where you can say absolutely there'll never be a problem at this distance, but the closer you are, the more likely you would be to have a problem.
And there was a bill approved Tuesday by the Pennsylvania House Committee that would extend that limit from 1,000 feet up to 2,500 feet, so that if a nearby water supply is polluted, the driller is responsible. So that's some coming legislation. Thanks for your call, Mike. We have Tom on the line from Du Bois. Hi, Tom. What's your question?
Well, my question was about the sludge or slurry that comes up, but I'd like to clarify something, if I could. I've understood it takes about 3 to 9 million gallons of water to frack one of these wells. And if there's only 1% of those chemicals in the water, that's still about 30,000 gallons of those chemicals that they're putting down in there. That would be per well bore, if I did the math right.
Yes, everyone here is nodding their heads. Yes, you did the math right. Yep.
Okay. And how much of that stuff stays down in there? I mean, are they able to take all of that fracking fluid out, or is there a percentage of it that stays in?
Dave?
So a percentage of the 30,000 gallons of whatever magical brew it is, that, you know, the lubricants or whatever it is.
Right. Yeah, well, basically anywhere from 90% to maybe 75% of the water, or the slick water frack fluids remain down whole. So you might get 10 to say 25% back up. So you would, in theory, get 10 to 25% of the 30,000 gallons. So I guess 3,000 to 7,500 gallons, something like that.
And of course, the issue is not exclusively the volume of the compound. It's also what that compound is. So very small concentrations of certain chemical compounds can be dangerous. We have a call from Joe on our live, a question from Joe in our live chat. Joe asks, after a well casing is installed and grouted, is there any pressure testing done to ensure that the grout seal is complete and the water table is protected? So when that well bore is put in, what do the regulations say? Tom.
There's actually several types of testing that have to be done. There's a logging, there's a pressure testing to make sure that, again, the integrity of that process is in place. And that is something that there's an inspection process that is part of the DEP rules and regs out there, and part of what's being stiffened in the new rules that are about to be put in place.
So someone from DEP comes out when that well is put in before it ever goes active?
It depends on the situation. It depends on what stage they're in. But there is an inspection process that does cover that piece as well. And again, that is a part of what they're looking to change right now and to make even more regulated.
Thanks. We talked earlier about the fact that fracking was exempted from the Clean Water Act, and we have an email question here asking why that was the case. Why is fracking exempted? And could Pennsylvania institute rules that were more strict than the Clean Water Act if it so chooses?
Well, the original exemption came largely from a study the EPA did that looked at hydrofracturing, the safety of it, and the Safe Drinking Water Act and whether there should be an exemption. And it were granted an exemption based largely on that study. Because of the concern that continues to persist, there's going to be another study by EPA. They'll be starting it shortly, if they haven't already, to determine if there should be more regulations on fracturing.
We have a call now from Carol in Kerwinsville. Hi, Carol. What's your question?
Hi. I just had a concern that it occurred to me that these companies, they say they will be fined if they can't, you know, if they pollute our streams or pollution for the pollution in that. In the past, I've seen where big companies can just afford to pay these fines. They sometimes I think they believe that it's just cheaper to pay the fine than it is to fix the problem. If this would be the case, what's beyond the fine? How many times will they be fined for contaminating water till they will be really actually held accountable?
Yeah. So the question is there something on beyond fines that would really make a company sit up and take notice?
Yes.
Everyone here at the table is nodding their head. Yes, Tom.
Something that I would put in there real quickly, we have seen up in the Dimmock area, for instance, where there was some fines that were levied against one of the companies because of gas migration. One of the things, and those fines are pretty big, you know, for most of us to take a look at, but maybe to a large company, it's not as big as it would be to a smaller company. The other thing to keep in mind when you look at that, though, is the company had to go back and actually plug several wells. So when you look at that, now you're talking about tens of millions of dollars in lost revenue as well as the cost to actually plug the well. And the loss that they had in, if you consider a well, was between $3 and $4 million to drill. So again, those at that point in time, that goes beyond just what the level of fine actually was.
Brian, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, and ultimately they can be shut down, and they have been shut down if they continue to do things wrong. The state DEP has the power to shut them down and have them stop drilling, and that has happened already.
That has happened here in Pennsylvania.
Yes.
Can you say what the company was?
I'd rather not, I guess.
Carol, does that answer your question?
Yeah, but it still doesn't help my concerns. I'm still very concerned about how the water actually can be cleaned up when something does go wrong.
All right. Well, thanks for your call. We appreciate hearing from you. We have Sue joining our live chat. She writes, I've heard we're the only state that does not have a severance tax for drilling gas shale. If such a tax were levied, would some of that money be put aside as a safeguard in case of environmental problems? In other words, would it be available for cleanup like the cleanup that will be needed in the Gulf Coast? I guess that's what our legislators are currently working out, right? Dave, did you want to talk about this?
Not really.
Tom.
Not so much to speak to the severance tax, but maybe as a generality, there is some discussion in some of the proposals that would be one of the potential uses.
Brian, what did you want to add?
That's been one of the controversies about the severance tax in its current form is that the bulk of the money would be put into the general fund for the state. And a lot of folks think that money should actually be put into an environmental fund if that's where it's going to go. But that's all being argued by legislators.
So, for instance, right now, if a company engages in illegal dumping of their fracking water and it contaminates a considerable drinking water, groundwater source, who cleans up and who pays for the cleanup?
The company.
Yeah, well, DEP would do an investigation and they issue orders. Once they make a determination who's responsible, they have the authority to issue the orders for the cleanup and the fines.
Mm-hmm. All right. We have a question here. This is an email question that relates. There was that case in Greene County, Pennsylvania, recently at Dunkard Creek. There was some kind of dumping, and everything that lived in the creek was wiped out, fish and mussels. And apparently the the cause was traced to something called golden algae. And the question is, what can you tell us about investigations there and who's responsible and how that's being cleaned up? Yes,
I can address it. It's my understanding, based on what I've read, is that the golden algae is in essence an invasive species, and it only thrives under certain conditions, including high total dissolved solids conditions in the water, and that those conditions have existed in that stream for more than a decade, let's say. I don't know the exact time frame, but that's related to coal mining industry primarily. And so there are pre-existing conditions that occurred. And to my knowledge, there has been no dumping of any flowback fluids from natural gas drilling that had anything to do with that. Although whenever you read about it in the media, they always put those two words, hydrofracturing and Dunkard Creek, in close proximity to each other. So basically, the two are exclusive of each other.
Mm-hmm. And how do you know how that problem is being addressed?
Well, they are monitoring it, and I'm not so up to date. Maybe somebody else here is right now.
Yeah, Brian,
I've been down there a couple times, and there is a lot of controversy there. I've not seen any definitive final report put together by EPA or the state different environmental departments. There was an implication of a deep injection well down there. That injection well has been closed now and is not accepting waste anymore. It was hydraulically connected to an underground mine pool, and there was some thought that that might have been responsible for some of the increase in TDS. That stream did have very high TDS. It did
total dissolved solids.
Yeah, that's right. Total dissolved solids. It was always high. It went much higher for a short period of time, and that was the concern about why that happened. So it's an ongoing investigation as far as I know, but there's some concern there about how that happened.
All right. Thanks for the info. We have a question from Sul Trim on our live chat asking, how is frack water transported to other states? This is a multi-part question, so let's take these one at a time. I guess, is frack water from Pennsylvania currently being transported to other states? Yes, Tom.
Yeah, we are seeing frack water that's being transported to other states, either for treatment or disposal. Sometimes that's being moved by tractor trailer. There's quite a few of those trucks moving down most of the interstates, and you can very readily see them. The other thing we're also seeing is some of that being moved by rail car. So actually moved either by pipe or by truck to rail car, loaded on the car, and then shipped to another state, again, either for treatment or underground disposal.
So obviously that's an expense to companies. There's the risk of spills at each point of transfer. Sultrim also asks, why do we export frack water to other states to inject into deep storage wells? Shouldn't we deal with our own byproducts of gas drilling? What's the thinking at the state level on that? Is there a move to keeping it more in state?
Well, I haven't seen a move that would require anything to be kept in state. I think ideally you would keep it in state, but we don't have deep injection wells in Pennsylvania that can accept Marcellus waste. They are in West Virginia and Ohio, and thus that's why they've seen it move across the state lines to those areas. I think as the recycling and reuse continues to increase, you'll probably see less of that, though.
Tom, you wanted to add something?
Well, I think there's also the topic of interstate commerce that comes into that discussion. It's not just we talk about the frack water there. You can also be thinking about some of the cuttings that are moving to landfills that are nearby. So as long as it's profitable to move it to another site because they have the treatment or the disposal options, that's really then becomes economically viable. What companies are looking at is options.
We have another question from our chat. Judith asks, do any of you panelists live on land where fracking is currently taking place? Tom.
Sure, I could address that. I actually own a farm, and we have 1, 2, 3 wells that are right adjacent to us that all have been hydrofracked.
So what does that look like on your farm?
No, it's adjacent to us.
Excuse
it's not
me.
Actually on
yes.
the farm.
What does it look like, the view from your farm?
What you see from the surface is just a well pad. So at this point in time, there are stone, gravel type well pads that are sitting there waiting for pipeline connections.
And how does your household get its drinking water?
We actually use the spring. So we would have the same concerns and would do the same testing that anybody else would go through for that same process for the same reason.
And Dave, were you going to say something also?
My family's farm, it's actually down the road from Tom's. live in the same neighborhood and basically have the same situation. You know, it's not on their farm, but they're, you know, in the general vicinity.
Mm-hmm. And how do they get their drinking water?
Via well.
Via well, okay. And did they have the well pre-tested?
I don't think they're in close enough proximity.
I see, okay.
But the water does taste bad in the first place, I'll note that.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to WPSU-FM. We're talking about Marcellus Shale drilling and its impact on water quality. We have three experts here in the studio to answer your questions. Tom Murphy is co-director of Penn State's Marcellus Initiative for Outreach and Research. Brian Swistock is a cooperative extension associate at Penn State who specializes in water resources issues. And Dave Yaxheimer is a hydrogeologist with ARM Group, a State College environmental consulting firm. Give us a call with your questions at 1-800-543-8242. That's 1-800-543-8242. Or send in a question by email to radiolive@psu.edu. You can also join our live chat online at wpsu.org/gasrush. And we'll get questions from that chat right here on the air, so send your questions in. Here's an email question based on the news. Does BP have any permits to do natural gas drilling in Pennsylvania at this time? Anybody know?
Not that I'm aware of.
No, they don't.
I don't think that they do natural gas drilling, if I understand that correctly.
They do, but just not in Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay. Right. Not in Pennsylvania. Here's an email question. There are endangered species in Pennsylvania that are in water habitats or in forest habitats. What is being done to protect endangered species from the impacts of water drawdowns? This is all related to the permitting process that we discussed earlier, right, Brian?
Yeah, there's a PNDI search that has to be done as part of the permit to look for things like endangered species and certain habitats that need to be protected as part of the permitting process. So that is a part of that initial well drilling permit.
And then under the state endangered species laws, there's also protection.
Yes.
Right. Here's an email question from Ron in State College. Ron says he heard in New York that Marcellus Shale drilling has been going on for a while, and there have been a number of cases where groundwater sources and aquifers were contaminated, presumably by fracking water. Can you confirm that that's the case in New York? Tom?
They've not been drilling in the Marcellus in New York State. There's actually a hold or a moratorium, so to speak, that's going on in New York State. So that would not be the case relative to Marcellus.
Right. That's my understanding, that there's currently a moratorium. Was there actually drilling before the moratorium, or was the moratorium put in place before any drilling ever happened?
Sure. There's been drilling in New York State for quite some time, drilling in other formations.
But in Marcellus Shale?
There was some very early work that was done in Marcellus Shale. And then at that point, they moved to, there was some Trend Black River, there was some Utica Shale, there was a variety of others that were done, Oriskany, again, a variety of shales and other stone layers up there.
Mm-hmm. But no drilling in Marcellus. Here's a comment on from our live chat from Andy. He says, can you tell us some of the environmental problems that have been caused by drilling into the Barnett Shale or other shale localities in other states? There's been similar kinds of gas drilling in Texas and Wyoming. Presumably, they're going through all the same things that we're going through here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, Texas is a little different. This is Dave. Because they do have more capacity for injection of the flowback fluids there. And so disposal is sort of a not a non-issue, but it's much less of an issue that it is here in Pennsylvania because we don't have quite the infrastructure to handle it that they do. So we're being a little more creative about it up here right now.
Brian?
Yeah, well, there have been some highly publicized studies done in places like Wyoming and Colorado that have looked at drinking water wells and found there to be problems with things like methane migration or higher chloride levels. Some of those studies, you often have to look at who's been funding those projects, and you'll find even the same data interpreted in different ways. So a lot of controversy about the conclusions of some of those studies, too.
Tom?
And the other thing, if you're thinking about the Barnett, one of the things that we've seen down in the Barnett is with injection wells, if they were injecting fluids, mainly the brines, into shallower horizons at high pressures, they were finding initially there were some issues with that showing up in abandoned wells that might not have been clearly marked. So in those cases, they've had to go back and replug those wells and then inject at a lower pressure. And in most cases, they've actually gone away from those upper zones and injected in much deeper zones to get away from the problem altogether.
We've been focusing on fracking fluid, and I want to return to one of the points we talked about earlier in the show, that one possible source of water quality problem is when well pads are constructed. And the simple act of construction of building roads and well pads can cause sediment runoff. And Dave, that's something that you work with drilling companies on?
Yeah, we do help them go through the permitting process. You know, in essence, if they disturb more than 5 acres, they have to get what's known as an earth disturbance permit in the state. And there's, you know, fairly stringent laws you need to follow and guidelines you need to follow to make sure you don't have sediment-laden waters running off the site into streams and impacting aquatic life.
And are most well pads bigger than 5 acres?
Nowadays, yeah, you can pretty much assume a Marcellus well pad's going to be 5 acres or larger.
And then what sorts of things do you actually physically do to prevent all this earth moving from washing into streams?
Right. Well, it's a matter of using best management practices in your engineering to basically not have focused stormwater runoff occurring. Kind of spread it out a little bit. Use a silt fence or other erosion control measures to keep it on the site and, again, prevent it from running off the site and into streams.
And who's checking to make sure that companies are actually doing this?
DEP. They're doing a pretty good job of getting out there and making sure that these pads and all the erosion control measures are being put in according to the specs.
So if they're not, what would the consequences be? Is this a case for a fine?
You know, notice of violation and an associated fine.
Mm-hmm. And then the company would be responsible for remediation?
Yeah, usually there's not like a major issue where you have a fish kill or anything drastic like that. It's more of sometimes they'll just give you a warning, and if you don't listen, you might get a fine and just basically, have to put better measures in place.
Thanks. That's really helpful. Here's a question from Catherine in our live chat. She wants to know, what is the proposed process for cleaning water that's been contaminated with toxins? So this is a question of wastewater treatment plants that are able to handle fracking water. What does a treatment plant need to be able to handle fracking fluid?
Well, this is Brian. Sorry. One of the proposed ways of doing that would be to use like a distillation or a crystallization process, which is basically distilling the water down to just very pure water and removing all the salt and everything else into a solid. You can use membranes to also remove those materials. This is very advanced and very expensive treatment, and that's going to be required really to meet some of these new standards for discharge of that into a stream. And hence, that's why we're seeing companies move toward the reuse and recycling. It's much easier, much less expensive to be able to reuse that water than treat it down to that level.
Thanks. Yes, Dave, you wanted to say something?
And you're seeing a lot of companies are actually treating the water on site. So they're reconditioning the water at the well pad so that they can reuse it at the next well pad, which helps keep trucks off the road and it's actually fairly environmentally conscious, I guess you could say.
So when fracking water comes back up, it often picks up salts from being deep in the ground. It needs to have a certain chemical composition to be reused as fracking water on another well, so they would dilute it. Is there a point at which it can no longer be reused? It's just been used too many times, like cooking oil in a fryer?
Yeah, that's a pretty good analogy. You could say that, the water kind of gets spent after so many uses and, the salts get to a certain point where it doesn't make sense to reuse it, so they'll treat it and dispose of it properly.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to WPSU-FM. We're talking about Marcellus shale drilling and its impact on water quality. We have three experts on hand to answer your questions. Tom Murphy is co-director of Penn State's Marcellus Initiative for Outreach and Research. Brian Swistock is a cooperative extension associate at Penn State who specializes in water resources issues. And Dave Yoxheimer is a hydrogeologist with ARM Group Incorporated, a state college environmental consulting firm. Give us a call with your question at 1-800-543-8242. That's 1-800-543-8242. You can also send us your question by email to radiolive@psu.edu. That's radiolive@psu.edu. And you can also join our live chat online at wpsu.org/gasrush. And we'll get your questions from the chat on the air. Here's an email question from Jenny. She wants to know about the effectiveness of fining companies for pollution. Even if they're punished with a fine, the water is still polluted.
Well,
Brian?
It's similar to the question we had before.
Yes.
About sort of this being pointless to fine them. You have to realize a number of things. The PR, the negative PR is going to be a problem. They can be shut down and have been shut down if they cause problems. The fact that the water is still polluted, they can be required to put in remediation systems to clean up the water too.
Dave, did you want to add something to that?
No, I think Brian's got that right on.
All right. We have a caller on the line. This is Jenny from Punxsutawney. Hi, Jenny. What's your question?
Hi. I had read that one of your Penn State geosciences professors had said that not only is the water that comes back up in a very salinic, but also could be contained arsenic, but radioactive waste. And at 30,000 gallons of already toxic brew, and then times each time they frack, which might be five times per well, times every 3 to 5 years for refracking, and then maybe 125,000 wells in the state or more, that doesn't sound too good to me.
Dave, you're a hydrogeologist. When fracking fluid comes up, is it radioactive?
There are naturally occurring radioactive materials known as NORM that does come back up in relatively low levels. To my knowledge, when this water is disposed of, they will actually monitor it to make sure it doesn't go above certain thresholds. And in general, it is below those thresholds.
And when the water is reused, can radiation be concentrated?
I suppose it could be on, you know, a certain level. But again, we're talking about very small levels in the first place.
Brian?
Yeah, that's been one of the concerns that's been raised, is that the bulk of the NORM usually ends up in the sludge from the treatment process, and then the disposal of that sludge. Where is that going to go to? Does it need to go to low-level radioactive sites? Or can it go to regular landfills? That's been one of the – but that's true of even a water treatment plant. They're also having sludges that are removed that have radioactive material too, so that's not unusual.
And then if you had sludge that was radioactive, what would be the disposal procedure for that?
Well, depending on the levels, it may have to go to a low-level radioactive waste facility, or landfills can accept it.
And is that the case currently in Pennsylvania, that there are drill sites where they're having to deal with sludge with radiation in it?
Well, the sludge is coming from the wastewater treatment
plants.
And as opposed to the cuttings that are coming from the drilling site itself.
But from a treatment plant that's dealing with water from gas drilling plants.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So that's currently a problem right now. Yes, Tom.
I think maybe two things here that sometimes we overlook. There's an assumption that made it that any and all landfills don't take any, up to this point, don't take any radioactive waste. And actually, there's a fair amount of radioactive waste that's generated, X-rays and from hospitals and other types of manufacturing processes. So DEP has a process in place to be dealing with that in a variety of places in Pennsylvania or specialized locations even outside the state in other states. There are some companies that specialize in that process and are also looking to do some of that work here and cite some of those very specific type of processes in Pennsylvania. The other thing that I wanted to maybe just take one moment and dispel was the idea that wells would be refracked every, I don't remember what the reoccurrence that she had mentioned, but on a very routine basis. And what we're seeing and learning is that will not likely be the case in Pennsylvania in the Marcellus Shale for a variety of reasons, and the economics would be one of them. So I think often that is put out there, and actually it's not exactly the case that we're seeing.
All right, Jenny, thanks for your call. Earlier we had a caller ask if folks here at the table had a personal interest, whether folks had gas wells on their land. And here's a question from our chat. Are any of the companies that are drilling Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania owned by people who are Pennsylvania residents, or are these all companies from away?
No, there are companies, this is Dave, Pennsylvania-based companies that are dealing with exploring and developing the Marcellus Shale.
And are you able to say who those companies are?
I'd probably rather not get into the corporate. Anyway, I could give them some free advertising. But, you know, if you go online, there are companies that are based in Pennsylvania that are you know, basically they came from the conventional shallow gas industry and now find themselves sitting upon a pretty rich deposit of Marcellus gas and going for it.
So this is a big topic. There's a lot of coverage. There's a lot to learn. If folks want to become better informed, can you recommend a concise place that people can go to get more information? Tom?
We have a number of locations where we're trying to store a lot of the educational materials, depending upon what your particular interest is. We have our website, naturalgas.psu.edu. We also have our marcellus.psu.edu. Brian, you have a site.
Yeah, just water.cas.psu.edu. We have a Marcellus section to that, too.
And just repeat that again so if folks didn't catch it the first time, they can jot it down.
It's water.cas.psu.edu.
And if an ordinary citizen thought they saw something, needed to report something, had a question, is there a hotline? Is there someone they can call?
There is an EPA hotline. I don't know the number off the top of my head, but it's an 800 toll-free number that EPA has set up to report problems. You can also call the DEP Bureau of Oil and Gas.
Any other numbers, or that's the best one?
You could also go to the River Basin Commissions. Both of them have reporting systems in there, and you can contact them either online or through their 800 numbers.
That's the Susquehanna River Basin Commission.
That would be correct. Or if you're ever in the Delaware River Basin, you could do the same thing over there. So those numbers are pretty readily available, and all those are hosted on our website, I believe at this point, yes.
Well, that sounds good. Mm-hmm. We have a call from Jules in State College. Hi, Jules. What's your question?
Given that the Earth as a system has a total amount of water that's unlikely to increase, and the recent technological disaster in the Gulf with the oil, what is the justification for the use of fracking when technology tells us we can be safe and we really aren't? Thank you.
Who'd like to tackle that?
Gosh, it's hard to do in a short... This is Brian. Yeah. It's hard to answer that in a short period of time. Of course, the rationale for the fracking is it has to be done to economically get gas out of this formation. The loss of the water from the fracturing is relatively small, even though you're leaving a fair amount of water under the ground, perhaps for an extended period of time. No one knows exactly how much of that's going to come back over 20 or 30 years. We're talking a short period of time where 15 or 25% comes back, but we think quite a bit more will eventually come back and have to be treated. But there will be some loss of water, but it is small in the overall scheme of things.
Jules, thanks for your call. Here's a question from our live chat. Are the majority of operators, drilling operators in Pennsylvania, complying with DEP regulations? And I guess a broader question would be, is there some sort of statewide reporting system so that you can sort of get a sense of the frequency of problems, the frequency of spills, or the frequency of illegal dumping? Tom, you're nodding your head. Yes.
Yeah, actually, we've been tracking that. That is publicly available. You can go online and you can review that on an ongoing basis. What we've been watching is the different types of violations and trying to break them out into the different components. We also have been talking to our DEP contacts and colleagues about that in particular. The point that they make, and I would repeat here, is not every violation is the same. There's a difference between 500 gallons of diesel fuel that might be spilled on the surface near a swamp and somebody that turned in a report about something and, you know, the I's weren't dotted and the T's weren't crossed, or a silt fence was knocked down on a particular site with ENS. So you really need to look at what the differences are. And what we've seen as we analyze and go through them is there are more ENS violations than there are some of the others. One thing to keep in mind, too, I think maybe this would be a good time to mention about it. I've been thinking about it as you've been going through the questions, is you look at the number of wells that have been drilled in Pennsylvania. Right now we're about 1,200 Marcellus wells, and there's probably 2 to 3 dozen wells that there's been an issue with. So you can crank through the math in terms of a percentage basis, but you can see how many where there's been problems and how many where there's not been a problem.
What I hear you saying is that's a small number.
Well, that's the math would indicate that anyway.
And do you know how that compares to similar kinds of equations in, say, Texas or Wyoming?
Actually, I've not done that.
Are we doing a better job, worse job?
We'll have to do that comparison.
Yeah. And this reporting system for spills and problems, you distinguish between big problems and small problems. Is that how it's reported? So in different categories of incidents, so you can sort of sort that out?
You can actually go in there and sort them out.
Mm-hmm. Brian?
And that's within a DEP system called eFacts. There's an e-notice system that allows you to be notified of permits. There's an eMap where you can go in and actually locate the permits. And then there's an eFax system that allows you to look at inspection reports, violations, et cetera. So those are all DEP websites that people could look at if they wanted to find that information.
Great. Just a reminder that you can call us with your questions at 1-800-543-8242. That's 1-800-543-8242. Or send a question by email to radiolive@psu.edu. We have a call from Patty in State College. Hi, Patty. What's your question?
Hi, yes. My question is related to erosion and sedimentation. And you mentioned that the gas industry has to do an E&S plan if they're over 5 acres. How come the rest of anyone else who's doing land development has to do an E&S plan if it's 1 acre or greater? So why is the gas industry exempt for those 4 acres? And then my second question is also, how come the conservation districts were removed in reviewing those E&S plans, but you know they're still reviewing them for all other land development?
All right, let's take those one at a time. Is it different for gas companies as opposed to other people doing development, 1 acre versus 5 acre?
No, it's not actually.
This is Dave.
Yes, this is Dave. And yeah, anybody who's disturbing more than 5 acres still has to get the same erosion and sediment control plan permit. So there's no exemption there.
This is Brian. There's always going to be a plan. Even if they're under 5 acres, they're going to have an erosion and sediment plan. The permit is the 5 acre threshold.
Patty, the second part of your question? All right. Well, we also have a call here from Jeff in State College. Jeff, you're on the air. What's your question?
Thank you for taking my question. What are the regulatory requirements, if any, to evaluate the groundwater impact and seal the shallow drill holes from seismic exploration that's used to characterize the subsurface geology?
Brian.
Yeah, related to water resources, there really aren't, there isn't much. There are regulations on the actual explosives that are used, the handling of them, et cetera. But the holes that are left behind, we certainly recommend that people make sure those are filled in and stipulate that in a lease arrangement and also stipulate a setback or keep those seismic explosives away from water supplies. But those are not requirements. Those are things people would have to stipulate or ask for.
Dave, you wanted to add something?
Nope.
Tom?
The other thing I would say along those lines, if there is a shallow water table and they're filling them back in with gravel, it's a good idea for them to insist for a bentonite clay plug to be put in so that you don't have surface water intruding down into a shallow groundwater table.
All right. Thanks for that information. We have just a little bit of time left, and I'd like to use that time to ask you to tell us one more time if people would like to go for more information. Tom, what's the web address that they should consult for your organization?
Our two web addresses would be naturalgas.psu.edu or marcellus.psu.edu.
And Brian?
water.cas.psu.edu, and you'll see a link to Marcellus water information there.
All right. Well, we're just about out of time here. I want to thank all of our guests tonight and also thank our listeners for their lively questions and for joining the discussion. We invite you to continue this conversation online. Well, we'll have an archive of this broadcast. Our guests tonight have been Tom Murphy, co-director of the Penn State Marcellus Initiative for Outreach and Research, Brian Sistock, Cooperative Extension Associate at Penn State, and Dave Yoxheimer, hydrogeologist with ARM Group Incorporated. For all of us at WPSU, I'm Cynthia Berger. Have a good night.